Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
There'll be some new faces in this year's Anzac marches around the country. They'll be the returned servicemen and women from conflicts in Iraq and more recently in Afghanistan. Many of those vets will be suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and not even know it. Doug Brewer is the post-traumatic stress disorder program coordinator at one of the many clinics around the country working with our returned service personnel. His clinic is in Western Australia. It's the Hollywood Clinic. Doug, thank you for your time. Let's start with a working definition of what PTSD is.
Post-traumatic stress disorder is the name that we give to people who do not bounce back after experiencing a traumatic or series of traumatic events. When I say bounce back, usually we recover and we don't have any long-lasting effects from a traumatic event. But for lots of reasons to do with the event, the number of events, and to do with the circumstances, we don't recover in a way that we see the world or ourselves or others as we did prior to that event. And when that interrupts with our capacity to enjoy life or have the same quality of life that we had before, we define that as being post-traumatic stress disorder. It's identified by three groups of behaviours. The first group are to do with re-experiencing the event in some way. There's a sense in which we relive the traumatic event or events as though they were happening again. And that may be in dreams, it may be intrusive thoughts, it may be by flashbacks, etc. The second group of symptoms that we look for that identify this disorder is what we call arousal. We see that the person is often acting in a way as though they're in fight or flight mode. They are hyper-aroused, hyper-vigilant. They're very quick to explode. So anger, as we often call it, which should be redefined as aggression, because when we're in fight or flight mode, we do things aggressively. We're not half-hearted. If we're running, we run furiously. If we want people out of a road, we'd push them out of our road. So with PTSD, there's also a sense, a high correlation with what people would generally describe as angry. They explode rapidly. There's the flip side of arousal. Also under that umbrella, a sense of being depressed, not having any energy, being very lethargic. The third group of symptoms that would help us to identify this disorder is avoidance and numbing. So in order to avoid exploding or feeling overwhelmed by re-experiencing the trauma, we avoid anything that reminds us of that. We avoid people that are likely to stress us. Stress will cause the symptoms to increase. So we socially isolate ourselves. We become a little bit like a hermit. We don't go out where there are crowds of people because it's too difficult to monitor our environment because we've been hypervigilant. So avoidance is what we see, and numbing, although we don't sit down and say, I'm not going to let my feelings surface anymore, we do at some subconscious level start to numb our capacity to feel our emotions or experience our emotions. So we try not to pay attention to them, and so that third group includes both the avoidance and the numbing that we see that goes on with PTSD. Very often people that we live with, if we have PTSD, will say we're no longer warm, loving people. We've become emotionally numb, and that's a byproduct of the PTSD.
Doug, it sounds like a desolate, at times lonely existence. Can I ask how veterans who are coming out of, say, the Afghanistan conflict differ in the exhibition of those symptoms and how they're treated?
Yes. Look, traditionally, people came back from war as veterans, and it was a clearly defined end to the conflict. and usually, fortunately, victorious. That wasn't the case, of course, with Vietnam, and was one of the reasons why we saw such an increase in post-traumatic stress disorder following the Vietnam War. Nowadays, with contemporary veterans, as we call them, there's a difference again. Warfare has become very much, as Vietnam commenced the change, in that it was very difficult to see who the enemy were. They no longer wore uniforms. There were no longer clearly defined lines. So in current warfare, we're much more likely to be involved with domestic situations where we're not sure. There is no uniform. There is no distinction between who's likely to be a combatant. It may be a woman. It may be a younger child than we would want to see involved in warfare. We might be able to. The only safe way to proceed is to see everyone of that culture or that country that we may be in for that conflict to be a potential enemy, and that doesn't go well with our moral codes. We still hold very strongly to what we see and what we have learnt in our early upbringing, and that's not always shared by other cultures.
Given the moral quandary that is at the heart of this contemporary PTSD, are we seeing a greater reticence for those who are suffering with it to put their hand up and ask for help because it might be more of a reflection of them? Or is the education that's gone into our community that says it's okay to accept that you need help actually having a positive effect?
Look, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that it's having a positive effect. There's room for improvement, of course, and we've got a long way to go. But the military has certainly identified the need and put high on their agenda the need for making it clear that mental health doesn't mean anymore an end to your service career. We're now seeing and treating a large proportion of our cohorts that go through are in fact currently serving personnel. Now, many of them will, because of the severity of the damage, will not be able to return to active duty, but it's no longer a given. What we're looking at is getting people treated early so that they can return to their careers, or at the very least that they're not in a case where they are going on to a pension and unable to work for the rest of their life. We're wanting to get them back to recovery, whether that's to work or a contributing member of society, getting them to recover their position of being a husband, a father. That certainly is the aim of treatment nowadays, and it is having there is a vast improvement. We're getting people coming in for treatment much earlier. There is still one of my concerns is that many people are leaving the military still at the moment, thinking that they're okay and not realising that it takes some time. And of course, being a young man or a young woman in the services, you have that very strong positive sense that give me enough time, I'll recover. Now, that's not always the case. Evidence shows if the symptoms haven't dissipated 12 months following the events, then they'll be there lifelong until treatment. And so we see young men who and women who have left the services going into often into fly-in, fly-out roles or other industry, and then in the 12 months that follow, they're turning up at GPs with a group of symptoms, only to find out that they too have been damaged and they need to undertake treatment to get recovery. Recovery is possible. In fact, we look nowadays for post-traumatic growth so that people actually grow from the experience they've been through.
Douglas Brewer, I know that we've caught you in between patients. Thank you so much for your time. And you can find more on Doug's work at hollywoodclinic.com.au in WA.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Chapman was a sergeant major with the ADF and seconded to the British forces to serve in Afghanistan. Paul, welcome to Open House. While you were training with the British forces in the UK prior to your Afghan posting, when did you begin to realise that this conflict was unlike any other?
Probably the last 3 or 4 months. In England, there's a lot of coverage on their soldiers in regards to what's going on in Afghanistan, and there are a lot of fatalities. and there are a lot of injuries as well. And you'd also see it on the base walking around.
When you got there, what did your service look like? What were you doing on a day-to-day basis?
I was a sergeant major. I was deployed out to a Danish forward operating post, and there was seven Australians, including me, about 30 Brits, and then Danish were up there as well. So my sort of day-to-day duties were running around looking after the forward operating base as a sergeant major, and also looking after the gun line. So I'm an artillery, so I looked after the guns and made sure they were technically shooting correct and well for the soldiers.
Describe for us what a forward operating base does. Are you right on the front line by virtue of that?
Yeah, not that it's, you don't sort of have a front line anymore, but yeah, you're right. We're pretty far, about 40 clicks out from the Brits' main base. And yeah, you could say we were on the front line. We were a forward operating base, and there was another patrol base, which is a lot smaller than what we are, about 5 kilometres away, and we pretty much supported those guys a lot of the time.
Were you injured at any time, or did you come home physically largely as you went?
On my second day in the forward operating base, we were engaged or attacked by the enemy, and I sustained injuries from that. Because of the adrenaline, I pretty much just kept pushing on just to do my job. I knew I had injuries, but I could just manage them while I was over there. I suppose it wasn't anything, broken bones, but I did sustain injuries, yeah.
When you came on home, when did you start to realise that not everything was right?
Initially, once we got back, we arrived at midnight in Brisbane, and the cameras pushed in our faces and interviews, and that made me quite nervous. I had some leave, I went back to work, and then I realised, and I think a few other people realised, that I was getting a bit edgy. I was angry, I was nervous and anxious all the time. I couldn't sleep. I was sort of going home and sleeping in the daytime because I'd be awake most of the night.
Wow.
So yeah, it was probably about four or five months after I went back.
And what were you telling yourself during this time, Paul? Were you suggesting that there's something wrong, mate, just buck up, focus on the next job, this isn't what you're supposed to be doing or how you're supposed to be feeling? What language were you using to yourself during this phase?
I knew that something was wrong, but I didn't understand what it was. So I kept it to myself. I didn't even do PTSD. I just thought that maybe this is a resettling in period. For instance, I used to go to the mess for dinner and breakfast and lunch, but I'd go first thing in the morning before anyone was there because I had a really bad tremor.
Mm.
And it's still food and dropped off my fork, so I'd go really early, and then I'd be the last person in the mess at night time before the place closed. And all the staff knew that. They said, oh, you're in, we know it's almost time to finish because you're in last. So I pretty much kept it to myself. I didn't know what was going on, to be honest.
What were friends and family saying around you at this time? Were they starting to realise something was wrong?
My wife didn't know anything was wrong. None of my friends knew what was wrong, or they didn't say anything. When I initially got back, I had, like I said, some leave. And my son was playing ice hockey then. We were sort of up and down to Brisbane all the time.
Mm.
And with all the parents, we'd stand around and talk, and I felt like I was in a bubble. I was alien. I didn't... couldn't relate to what was they were talking about or what was going on. I was just really, really alienated.
When did you end up seeking professional help? Were you recommended, or was this just a day where you picked up the phone and said, I need to speak with Defence Care?
I actually went to the doctor one day with some sort of flu symptoms, I suppose, and he asked me about my tremor in my hand, and I said, oh, look, I do that all the time. He then asked me if I was sleeping okay at night, and I said no. And then a few other questions. Then he sent me straight down to see an army psych to have a bit of a chat.
Yeah.
And it sort of snowballed from there into a psychiatrist appointment in Brisbane, and that's when I first sort of was told what it could be, yeah.
Paul, what's the language around PTSD? Can you be cured from it? And if so, where are you at right now?
Look, a lot of people tell me, my father-in-law was a Vietnam veteran, and he suffered with post-traumatic stress, and he still suffers the effects. He's still on his medication. A lot of people, my psychiatrist told me that it is something that you will stay with you. And you really have to learn to manage the symptoms, triggers, etc. like that. I've just come back from the Currumbin Clinic where I see my psychiatrist up there. I spent about 3 weeks up there, and he changed all my medication around, and I feel a lot better in my head at the present time. I was on a lot of heavy medications, which I'm not on now. So, yeah, that's what I'm up to. So I'm just sort of taking it easy a couple of weeks out from getting out of hospital, just easing myself back into, you know, routine. Like, just going to the shop is a real nightmare for me because I just sweat profusely, get nervous, and I'm always checking. So I'm just trying to ease myself back into it, trying how to learn to manage the symptoms.
Paul, I know this conversation isn't an easy one for you to have, but it's important that you get a chance to share like this, isn't it?
Look, since I was sent home from work, I've been a real advocate of speaking out about this type of thing. I've had a few mates that have kept it quiet to themselves and amongst their close family, and they lose all their friends. And I just figured, look, I'll just tell people what's going on. It does make me nervous. It makes me think about things when I talk on the radio or talk to whoever about this. But I think it's good in a way. It's more so to get the message out to everyday Australians, I suppose, and any other soldiers maybe suffering from symptoms like this.
You mentioned your family before, that as much as you try, it is inevitably going to affect them. Let's talk about how we as family members and mates can support somebody who's living through PTSD like you are doing right now. What can we do to help you?
Jeez, that's a real hard one. I think understanding and knowing and learning about the disease or the itself, you know, I take my wife to my psych appointment sometimes, and he'll explain things to her so she's got more understanding, because before this happened to me, I'd heard of people having PTSD, but I didn't have any understanding of it. So I think just more so sort of understanding what it is and what it does, and just being there for someone. You know, when I have really hard times at home, you know, my wife will say, go into the room and just have a lie down, or she'll see me at the shops and she'll say, we'll go outside for a little while. So pretty much just knowing what the symptoms are, what your triggers are. And they're all different for each individual person, but I think that's the way to go.
Paul, from inside the services, is it still seen as a sign of weakness or, worse still, failure that somebody should be afflicted by post-traumatic stress?
That's the perception, or it was the perception, in defence, from as far as I could see. But I think things have changed a lot in 3 years, and I think people are more aware of it. Certainly the hierarchy in units are aware of it, and it's more commonly spoke about amongst troops right now, you know, today.
Paul Chapman, I know that at times this has been a difficult conversation for you, so thanks so much for your honesty and your time today, and all the best with your continued recovery.